Who was able to enjoy Ruth in the last week? Could I just see a show of hands? Was that not a needed breath of fresh air? And I think we can observe an important lesson there, that when Scripture is difficult to work through, and maybe we think that's particularly the case with the Old Testament, it's stretched out with these longer narratives, so sometimes it takes a longer time to get to that. I won't do that again, sorry. But you keep reading. You keep reading, because you will not read these holy scriptures without encountering the wonderful grace of God. That will not happen unless your heart is totally hardened to him and his character. I'd like to pick up where we left off last week, because there were just a few of those eyesight word uses that I didn't get to. We got to it sort of in summary, but I just want to just brush through them really quick, because it sets us up for Ruth in a unique way. Now, we know Ruth is a refreshing story. We know that it's a life-giving story. But it's important to remember and try to slow down, even though the narrative's quick at the beginning, the setup here. Okay? So that's part of the reason I want to go back before I go forwards. So Judges, last week we had gone through all the uses of eyes or sight to follow the narrative. And you can do that somewhat with Ruth, which some of you might have paid attention to that, particularly in chapter 2 of Ruth this week. But I just want to look through these last couple uses. So let's go here. Following Samson, who was the last one we really spoke specifically about this, the use of the eyes, Samson's eyes being gouged out, and him being the last judge in this series, we see this rapid decline. And the decline is marked by a return of that phrase, right in their own eyes or good in their own eyes, and the emphasis of that, but it's also carried by a repeated phrase that shows up, I think, 4 times, which is, in those days there was no king in Israel, which up to that point is sort of like, well, yeah, because there's been no king in Israel. I mean, why would there be? And when we get to 1 Samuel, we can see that it's actually dicey when the people are asking for a king. So we know, okay, that the authors here are creatively setting us up. In those days, there was no king, so that's got loaded meaning. And everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So this is the end of the story of the judges, when we don't have any more mention of judges. And then we did talk about this last week, but I failed to mention that there was 2 uses of eyes or sight in that desperate situation with the Levite and his concubine and the assault and murder of her, right? And Gibeah, this place that was supposed to be safe, is more like Gomorrah. And the judgment ensues in, so this is the description of kind of the middle of that act. It sounds just like the encounter of Lot and the angels in Sodom and Gomorrah, and the protector bringing in the house, offering up the women instead. But again, this phrase, the people who are harassing the home of refuge say, well, do what's right in your own eyes, what's good in your eyes. And that, of course, brings war with the Benjamites. And it's a pretty unhappy ending. You could say it's somewhat ambiguous at the end. All the tribes kind of do what they're supposed to. They all go to their own place and settle down. But to accomplish that, the tribe of Benjamin has to pilfer and steal from dancers who are celebrating at Shiloh. And so they have to steal wives for themselves. And that's how Israel is made whole. And so it's this really unhappy ending. And repeating word for word what we saw in Judges 17, it ends, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." So that's quite the setup for Ruth. As are all the judges. Now, this isn't, you know, perfectly chronological. Obviously, with the opening of Ruth being in the days when the judges ruled. Literally, it's when the judges judged. It's the same verb used twice. Just so we know what period this is. In the days when the judges judged. And so it's not sort of after the end of Judges, but it's in the mix there. But it's in the mix of that constant wavering of the judges cycle and the back and forth and the spiritual decline. And so when you come to Ruth, and the first sentence you get is this, "In the days when the judges judged," at this point it's like, that is not a story I want to read. I don't want to read more stories about the judges and the spiral down and the calamity. And that's the setup here. And truly, it is an unhappy beginning. And again, we can read past this really quickly, but it's the whole setup for the power of this redemptive story. In the days when the judges judged, there was a famine in the land. So that's bad. Famine is very bad. And it was severe enough that a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. And I, just because this is a bit geeky and I like to share you some geeky stuff, I want to just raise something to your attention. Those last uses of the eyes and judges that I talked about during the spiritual decline, both of those stories, the sort of handmade weird religion that went on with a random Levite and a household god, and I know I didn't describe all that, but it involved a Levite who had sojourned out of Bethlehem, and there was mention of Judah. In that second story with the Levite and his concubine, the concubine was a Bethlehem Judah sojourner. And so if we're meant to pick that up here in the first sentence, in addition to the setup of in the day the judges judged, you have sojourn out of Bethlehem and the connection with Judah. And so that might be, I might be seeing a little bit too much there, but that seems to be repeated. And it will certainly be a trend that holds coming into David, and even with our Messiah. So that's just a little geeky side bit. Hopefully I didn't throw you totally off track with that. Okay. So what's the occasion of this book? It's a famine. It's bad news that starts the book. And what does Elimelech do, the family protector and provider? He takes his family out. Okay, so where does he take him out? That's where he takes him out. He goes out east to Moab on the other side of the Dead Sea. So they're going beyond their safe zone of Israel now. But before I talk about the where for a minute, how do you read Elimelech? Was this a good move? Was this a bad move? Do we see his eventual demise and the demise of his sons as a slam on his character or his decision to go out during famine? When I read it, sometimes I see it with that lens. But upon a few more readings, I had to slow down, and I just encourage you, when you're reading these narratives, not to try to force the spiritual and the judgment on or the moral on every issue. There are moral issues, matters of integrity, that the Lord wants to elevate in a narrative. But some are not for us to know. And Elimelech, if there's judgment suggested on his character and his decision to take his family out of Israel, then it's very minimal. And what helps us remember that is that this is not the first famine, and this is not the first Israelite to move his family. Because famine, you know, didn't mean you go to the next store. It meant that whole area was dry. You were going to die if you stayed. And so his options were very limited. And just to show you the occasion of other folks who fled wisely, from Genesis 12:10, now there was a famine in the land. So Abraham went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And Genesis 26:1, Abraham's son Isaac, now there was a famine in the land, besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And then in Genesis 43:1, the setup for all of the people of Israel coming into Egypt. Genesis 43:1, now the famine was severe in the land. And that's what brings all of Israel into Egypt, and then to multiply within Egypt, and to undergo slavery. So, you know, what's the best we can say about these movements? As far as we know, none of those famines was precipitated by those people's sins who sojourned. As far as we know, right? They didn't have to sojourn necessarily for their sin. And neither was it shown in any of those narratives to be from a lack of faith that sent them out to seek security. They did have an obligation to seek survival, especially the men who led their families. They had an obligation to care for their family and to go out, even if it was to go out to an enemy for a time. And so Elimelech was a man with few options. And if we're going to look into the names of these characters, and there's a lot here in Ruth, but I'm going to leave that mostly for Russ in another week to go through those names with you when we do our Zoom call-in. But Elimelech, I'll just give you his, means God is king. And anytime you want to follow this king theme, which is going to be massive for us going forward, look for the Melech at the back of the name, okay? Because that's the Hebrew of king, ruler. So look for Melech. So when you see Abimelech, that's something of king. When you see Elimelech, that's something of king. In this case, God is king. So as far as names go, Elimelech's got a good name. God is king. So what I'd suggest, when you come across natural phenomenon in the Bible that does not expressly tell you it's God's judgment, don't assume that it's a judgment on the characters in play, unless it's mentioned that way. But that doesn't mean we dismiss out of hand the connection of calamity with God's judgment. At this point, we might have said, you know, why did Naomi take it so close to heart? She talks about God really setting her up to be bitter. She doesn't just say, I lost things. She says, God did this against me. God's hand was against me. She says that in the narrative. She says, God's returned me empty. And so she's looking at a direct correlation between maybe sin and judgment. But part of why she's doing that is not just because she's only got her eyes on her circumstance. She's probably also got her eyes on the law. And what had the law promised for this promised land? Blessings and curses. And let's look at just a couple. Let me just mention a couple things that the blessings and the curses included and would have set Naomi up to think, I am being judged severely. And there's something wrong with me, which pushes, makes her a person who pushes others away. You don't want to be by me. I'm someone who gets judged. If you want to see these listings of blessings and curses, one of the bigger expositions of it is Deuteronomy 28. But here's just a few references for you. And this is stuff that would be rolling in Naomi's head more than it's rolling in ours when we accompany natural phenomenon and other harsh circumstances. Deuteronomy 28:5, blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. That does not mix well with famine. However, there is also an offsetting curse if the people went after other gods and fell. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. That's Deuteronomy 28:17. And then making reference to children and household and multiplication, Deuteronomy 28:11, and the Lord will make you abound in prosperity, in the fruit of your womb, in the fruit of your livestock, in the fruit of your ground. Within the land. Not wherever you go, but it was, the Lord will make you abundant in prosperity, abound in prosperity, in the fruit of your womb, in the fruit of your livestock, in the fruit of your ground, within the land that the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. So that land's supposed to be productive. This famine is not supposed to be a normal occurrence. And so it's actually right for Naomi to apply some type of moral, spiritual lens on this. And it might help when we read these narratives. You see the characters often, their first point of reference is to God or the gods, okay? Whether they're monotheists or pagan. Their first reference point is to God. And then sort of later down the line, they'll understand there's natural phenomena and there's other causes, but their primary reference point is God. And that's exactly flipped in our day. Our primary reference point is usually, well, that's sort of what happens. This is how the virus spreads. You know, this is the science. And we don't have to be anti-science. This isn't a contrast. It's a question of emphases. And usually the last thing we go, yeah, well, like the final cause is God. But let's not talk about God. Let's not spiritualize. Let's not talk about judgment. You know, that's too complex. And so there's a balance here. Ruth is on the other side. Ruth, Naomi, that whole generation is on the other side of it. We're on this side, and there's probably a place to meet in the middle there. So, where do they seek refuge? We know that Egypt's historically a dicey place for Israel to go for security. It works for a time and then it breaks down. It seems to be the case with every place outside of the Promised Land. So here, the setup is to go to Moab. And there is artistic, you know, reference we're probably supposed to read here in that Bethlehem means what? House of bread. And so the story is set up to leave the house of bread to get bread. So something is going wrong. And they go to Moab. And Moab's a messy background. Just to remind you, because it was loose in my own mind, I sometimes forget the Moabite connection. Moab is connected with Israel in that it's a progenitor is Lot, who is the nephew of Abraham. And so Lot has a wife. They're in Sodom and Gomorrah. In that account, they're brought out with their family. The daughters alone. The daughters aren't given mention here, which is why they show up here as mother of Moab and mother of Ben-Ami, and not given name, okay? It's because it's Lot's daughters. And right in there is that twisted story where the daughters feel desperate and the only way for them to be restored is to be with their father. And so there's a dark past here with Moab. But that's not actually the biggest issue, because Israel has many secrets in its family line. Many, many dramatic, okay, connections in its family line. This is not a pure tree, okay? And so that's not the primary issue. It's just to remember kind of the birthplace of Moab. The primary issue is that Israel and Moab have been extremely contentious. And Moab wouldn't let Israel go through. And then Moab tries to set itself up to curse Israel. And there's this really contentious relationship between the two. So contentious that enshrined in the Old Testament law is a warning about these people. Deuteronomy 23, 3 to 4. No Ammonite, okay, that's the other daughter's offshoot. So no Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. Whoa. This is a lot of hostility here. Enshrined in the law. No Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord, even if they want to worship, even to the 10th generation. None of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever. Why? Because they have a messy family history? No. That couldn't be an issue because Israel would be out. Because they did not meet with you with bread and with water on the way. So when you were sojourning, they were not a place of refuge. When you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor, from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. And so there's this loaded history, but there's also the connection to sojourners and seeking refuge, and because of that, a natural hostility, even enshrined in the law. And so this, just to emphasize it, this is a strange place to go to seek comfort and to seek refuge, and it highlights the desperation. And so I just wanted to go over that because it's easy to jump past that because we want to get to the refreshing and the love story between Ruth and Boaz and the power there. But this is a desperate time. A desperate time for these people, but a desperate time for Israel. And this story is bigger than Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz because it's the story of Israel and Israel's covenant husband. Yahweh. And it's a bleak start. So just as the Judges was a bad ending, Ruth is a rough beginning. And so it's marked by this sad sojourn. So it's not just a bad beginning that sets it up, but the actual sojourn works out even worse. It's like whatever situation had drove them out, it only got worse. So they went out seeking refuge and security. And Naomi's family is laid waste. By verse 3, Elimelech's dead. Fortunately, Naomi is left with her two sons. Sons marry, one verse later. By the fifth verse, both sons are dead. This is a massive, massive loss. And if we don't understand the weight of the loss, it's really hard to understand the glory of the redemption and the restoration. She had no heir. She had no protector. She now had no political status, no civil status. She had no social status. Some commentators say for a widow like this, no heir, you're essentially like our modern day homeless person. I mean, you're without a home and drifting, and you're surviving off the generosity of others, off the cars stopping, and handing out some cash. I mean, you are just surviving. And so it's a really, really desperate situation. It's not just a sad day. And so Naomi's got really no place left to turn when she does turn. And she returns home, which is the next major move in the story. So this whole thing is the setup. But those verses, verse 1 to 5, are incredibly important. Now we begin to be set up for this return, for this restoration. But it begins with Naomi in desperation, really only having one option left before her, and that's just to return home empty. That's all she's got left. It's her last move. Now, the added beauty of this story and complexity of it is that she's got these surviving daughters-in-law. And what's going to happen with them? And where are they going to go? Because they're not out of options. Because they're young widows. And because they're living among their people and among their gods. And they know people and they have connections and they have some resources there. And it's not all lost. And so when we consider that disparity, we can understand when Naomi begins pushing them away so fervently. She's saying, look, you've got options. You've still got choices. This is my last move. You've still got choices. Okay? And I don't know why, but God's hammer of judgment has come down on me. So keep your distance. But you still have options. If you come with me, what options remain? I'm not pregnant, so there's no sons for you. And if I did get married, would you hang around until I got pregnant? If I could, and I'm old, so that's unlikely. And so they've got options. So when Ruth and I always want to say Oprah, it's really messed up that narrative forever, but Orpah, when they come to this decision, it's a complex decision for them to make. Their mother-in-law, they've tied themselves to, who they love, or do they go back to the safety of their home? They really remain. They don't have to go back. They just have to not go out. For Ruth, she's got to go back. For these two daughters, they have to decide, am I going to go out or am I going to stay put? But the story begins to turn when, again, Naomi turns around. And I just want to read for you. I'm not going to go through all of them because there's so many. Just in that first chapter, that word return that you see here in the first verse, it's used 12 times just in that first chapter. We're intended to pick that up. Whenever you see a word, even in your English Bible, it's not going to be as clear. You're not going to see it as many times. Sometimes there's going to be words here like go back or turned or returned, and so we might not pick up on all of them. But whenever you see a word being repeated like that, follow that as far as it goes. And what you'll see here, and the reason why I'm spending almost all of my time with you today in chapter 1, is because this is where the bulk of this word is used. It's all in this setup. It's all in this decisive moment of will they return and who will return. And so 12 times it's used in chapter 1. And in the remaining three chapters, it's only used 3 times. So it's like all of the work and all of the setup is happening in chapter 1. And then the resolution comes out artistically and slowly and beautifully in the story of Ruth and Boaz. And it concludes with a final use of this word return that is so powerful. So all I'm going to do for you, because I know you want to hear the word of God, I'm just going to read for you this from this turning point, verse 6 of Ruth chapter 1 to Ruth 22. And just listen to how much turning is going on, how much the author really intends us to pick up upon this return. So Ruth 1, beginning with verse 6, all the way through 22. Speaking of Naomi, then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So that's the setup. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." And that idea of rest is also prominent in this book. Seeking rest, primarily Naomi seeking rest for Ruth throughout. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices, and they wept. And then they said to her, with initial resolve, both of them as strong as the other, they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back." She's saying, literally, return back. "Turn back, my daughters. Will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back again. My daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." And here we see her lens again, primarily her relationship to Yahweh. I want to stop for just a second there with that phrasing, because it's going to be different in some of your Bibles. When she says, "No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake," some of your Bibles won't say "for your sake." So she's not saying "on account of you," but it will say "more than." So that's a comparative use. So one sort of a "because of" or "on account of," the other is a comparative, "my bitterness and pain and sorrow versus yours." And a third use that other translators will pick up is that of "my bitterness is too much for you." Whatever it is here, there's a lot of bitterness, and Naomi is trying to emphasize hers over anybody's. She's saying, "No one's been judged like me. You know, you have lost a lot, but I've lost everything. You've lost much. I've got no more moves." And so she's really trying to put distance between herself and them here. And if it is that last case, "My bitterness is too much for you to bear," that is borne out in Orpah's response. She recognizes that this is too much of a cost for me to bear. For me to see you through to your death would be my undoing. I would forfeit my life. I would forfeit my hopes and chances. And that is too much. So continuing on, we see one turning away and one turning with. "The hand of the Lord has gone out against me," continuing in verse 14. "Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said," speaking of Naomi, "see, your sister has gone back. She's returned to her people and to her gods. Now you return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." This is an amazing statement of loyalty and commitment at great cost to herself. And it only becomes more emphatic with the following. It sounds like an oath that she's undertaking, not just, you know, typical language that they would use in the ancient Near East when you're talking to someone, but it sounds like she's putting herself under oath of death if she does not see Naomi through. So in verse 17, that's where we get that. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. And here's where the oath part comes in. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. You see, and that's why this is the end of the conversation here. She has just vowed herself to Naomi. She has made an oath in front of the Lord. May the Lord judge me beyond death. If I don't see you through to death, to care for you, to make sure you have a proper burial and everything that's involved. And so it's a beautiful picture of this generous love. And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred up because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" Is this Naomi? And Naomi responds, getting ahead of any gossip or any of their own judgments. She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi," which means sweetness or pleasantness. Sorry, Russ, I'm taking some of your thunder. These ones are unavoidable. "Do not call me Naomi, but call me Mara." It's the same word she had used to speak about her exceeding bitterness that the Lord had brought her. And she'll say it again what follows. "So call me Mara, call me bitter, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full." Interesting, even though she went away in a famine, they had nothing, they were desperate. But she had a family, she had a husband, she had male heirs, she had a hope. "I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" And that concludes the final return. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. And that mention of barley harvest is the introduction to the whole encounter with Boaz. And that whole beautiful relational development. And just to emphasize here, throughout Ruth, and you can even see it here in verse 22, we already know Ruth. We already know where they've been. We already know she's a Moabite. But look how much the author wants to point out that this is a foreign woman, and now she's going to come into a foreign place. So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, we already know that, Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab, we already knew that. And so there's just this hyper-emphasis on this sojourn and also this foreigner aspect. And so now this gets to the best part, right? The love story. But I'm going to pretty much just jump past it all, and not primarily because of time constraints, but because the beautiful how of this restoration is secondary to the fact that there is restoration. All of our restorations to the Lord, restorations in this life, but especially restorations spiritually, in the deepest way that matters most, those will be unique to all of us. And this restoration story is glorious and beautiful and lovely, but it's secondary to the fact of God's commitment to redemption and restoration with a character who, honestly, we don't know her level of faithfulness to Yahweh. We know she's not a good evangelist, instead of saying, come with me, I worship the true God. Come with me. There's always hope with Yahweh. Come with me. He says, return back. Go to your gods. Like, what's my God going to do for you? So it's questionable, ambiguous at best. And yet the story, which is called Ruth, and which we want to talk about Ruth and Boaz now, I'll save it for another day, I don't think the story is really about Ruth. And the clearest indication is that the opening begins with Naomi, and it's always emphasizing her bitterness, her loss, her expense, her sojourn. And if that weren't clear enough, when the story winds up, when Ruth and Boaz come together, when they have a child, and so Ruth is preserved, there's very little mention of Ruth being preserved, though she's so happy. The conclusion of the book is Naomi's restoration. And this is important because Ruth is emblematic of Israel on a whole in its relationship to Yahweh. Israel, who is ambiguous at best, sometimes treacherous, often treacherous with Yahweh, its covenant head, and yet who continues to be returned to their land, continues to see restoration and redemption offered, continues to be given a hope from Yahweh. And so Naomi actually would be a great name for this book. It's so obvious when we get to the end. The final use, I'm skipping over the two in the middle when that introduced the Boaz-Ruth relationship and the mention of a redeemer, which is huge, but we just can't do that all. But when you get to the end, in verse 15, well, let me read that last passage and just look at the emphasis on Naomi's restoration over and above Ruth's and whatever good has come to Boaz, but this wandering child of Israel has been brought back, and there is redemption made for her. So from verse 13 of chapter 4 on, so Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women, so the women of the town, remember those whisperers, is this Naomi? Everything has turned. The women said to her, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer. You, Naomi, more than Ruth, more than this foreigner, who is, yes, sort of the first fruits of the redemption of the Gentiles, and the first fruits of that blessing to bless all the nations through Abraham. That's there as well. But primarily here, this restoration to Ruth. Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life. Literally, a returner of soul or life or being. He is bringing you back. You came back physically, but your soul, your lifeblood, your passion, your pleasantness was gone. But this son will be the one who brings back your soul, who returns. It's that last use of the word return. And this son would return to you, your soul. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, whoa, has given birth to him. And then an amazing thing is said here, and commentators will span the whole spectrum on this. The important thing is the relationship with Naomi and this child is a clearly very tight bond. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. So some would say Ruth actually gave the child for Naomi to adopt. But in any case, there's this extremely tight bond that is formed. And it's tight enough that the women in the neighborhood would say one more thing, which is kind of this sneaky narrative piece that's connected, what the women are saying about Naomi. There's what Naomi's saying about her own condition, and then what the women are saying. You know? And we care about what the women are saying about us and what the men are saying about us, don't we? And here, they can't deny the redemption that's come. And they say this amazing thing. And they don't say it to Ruth, they say it to Naomi. The women of the neighborhood gave him a name, speaking of the son, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." Do you see that? She did not bear a son. But they are recognizing the power of this redemption. When we look at this genealogy, we can think about how amazing it is that this Moabite hostile enemy has somehow come into the direct line of King David. And as a function of that, the direct line of our King Jesus. And we can marvel at that. But let's also remember Naomi, for whom the story centers. Because Naomi, who seemed to have no heir and no hope and no continuance, Naomi is brought into that line through Ruth. And so Naomi is restored. And the restoration is so complete that other people looking on say, "A son has been born to Naomi." This is a blessed, beautiful redemption. I think even more beautiful, even more powerful than the amazing story that is Ruth and Boaz as the in-between. And they named him Obed. I'll leave that one for Russ. But Obed was the father of Jesse and the father of David. What can we take away from this kind of safely, wisely? One, we can be refreshed and renewed that this covenant-keeping God is a restorer and a redeemer. He is one who brings back. We can also take from this that there is a turning required. Now, I don't want to over-spiritualize this, but there was a return that needed to happen. And when I think about Ruth, that was the most costly return you could imagine. She was forfeiting so much potential prosperity and earthly hope because she was connected to this woman she was loyal to and at least loosely connected to her God, such that her choice is inscribed in that beautiful language. I'll read it again there. Ruth's commitment to turn to the Lord, "For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God." I think a wise thing we can take away from this is just an understanding that there are times in our lives practically where we are required to cut our losses, either physically or spiritually, cut our losses. We have gone down a road, maybe with good intentions, maybe with mixed intentions, maybe with awful intentions, but we've gone down a road and it has not borne out what we thought it would. And if we're there, the temptation is just to stay. Because what am I going to turn back? I've already gone so far with this thing. I'm so far. How am I going to turn back from that? I'm so connected. There would be so much mess. But there are times, and I don't know when that time is for you. The Spirit of God has to apply this, and you have to be honest with Him. But there are times where we have to cut our losses, and physically or spiritually, return to the Lord and say, okay, whatever benefit I thought this was giving, whatever security I've gotten this, it's time to cut my losses and it's time to come home. But there's also Ruth, who is not in this situation. And some might be in that situation. And the question there will be, will you take the risk? To not return, but to go out. To make that initial first move, to follow, to seek after God. To approach something you know he's calling you to. You know he's called you to it. But there's restraint. It's safer here. I know this place here. I'm okay here. Like, I can manage here. I think this happens in all of our hearts as we approach the Lord for that first time. If there is a clear first time, am I going to go out? Am I going to seek after? Am I going to tie myself to this God, come what may? And no one can do that. No one can do that but you. Each person has to go out in that way. And so there's a time to cut losses and go back. There is a time to maybe cut profits and go out. To cut what gains you have to have a better thing. And for us, that better thing is a redeemer. And this redeemer, follow the connections, would be one born in Bethlehem, of Judah, that little town, one who would have to sojourn this time to Egypt for safety for a time, but then would be returning home to Jerusalem. And the buildup is for this awesome restoration and for this king and for this power and for this glory. And he dies because he did not come. King Jesus did not come for his restoration, but for ours. And he redeems us and restores us by his blood. And if you have not gone out to him, it's time. It's time to go out to him, to follow him in the waters of baptism, to cling to him like Ruth clung to Naomi, to cling to Jesus, come what may. Not everything will be perfect, but everything will be better. And in the end, everything will be perfect. Jesus is the one fulfilling Micah's prophecy, Micah 5:1. But you, O Bethlehem of Ephrathah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. This time it wouldn't be Mara or Ruth, but it would be Mary. Then the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel. And he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall dwell secure. For now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be their peace. This is Jesus, our restorer, who has come to bring us back. We praise him. Let us celebrate him at table. You don't have to do any studying at this point to recognize the connections with Bethlehem and the house of bread, and Jesus who called himself the bread of life. If you are one who has been brought back to the Lord, or you have gone out to the Lord, if you have sought your Redeemer, who is Jesus, partake with joy.